Hey folks, Heather Cox Richardson and Joanne Freeman here. Thank you for being members of the Cafe Insider community.
This is Backstage, a special segment of the Now and Then podcast exclusively for you. We hope you enjoy it.
Carol.
Yes.
Black Panthers. Everybody loves that they're carrying guns. Hey, could you insert them into this whole thing? Because, of course, isn't that how we get a real change in the way we understand guns in the period?
Oh, my gosh. And so think about the civil rights movement, and then we move into that era of the 1960s. And what you have happening is massive police violence raining down on Black folks in Oakland. And that there is no responsiveness from any of the political leaders to dealing significantly with that police violence raining down on the Black community. So the Panthers come together, the Black Panthers come together, and they say, we are going to police the police. We are going to provide defense to the Black community. And that defense is not shooting cops. That defense, though, is standing there and monitoring what the cops are doing, because and California had open carry laws. And so they knew, the Panthers knew the laws. The Panthers knew what kinds of guns they could carry. They knew how they were supposed to carry them. They knew where they could point, where they couldn't point. You know, they knew all of the rules about how far to stand away. The cops hated it. From the depths and the breadths and the heights that their soul shall reach, the cops hated having the Panthers sitting there watching them, monitoring them. And so they ran, the police ran to Don Mulford, who was a conservative legislator in the California Assembly. And they said, we need your help, because every time we pull the Panthers over, they're not doing anything illegal. I mean, everything they're doing is within the law. We need to make what they're doing illegal. And Mulford's like, I got this. And with the help of the NRA, he began crafting the Mulford Act that dealt with making illegal the way that the Panthers carried guns to monitor the police. And Ronald Reagan said, basically, I'm eagerly awaiting this bill to hit my desk so I can sign it into law. So the ways that we think about gun control, as the conservatives being against gun control, because these are the stalwarts of the Second Amendment. It depends on who's carrying the gun. That is the variable that matters here.
So how did that play out in the national conversation? So we do, in fact, get restrictions on gun carry. Going forward, though, I mean, I think that's the last time the NRA actually backed restrictions on gun ownership. Is that correct?
Yes, because from my understanding...
And they did back it.
They backed it. They backed the Mulford Act. And so, but you see that there's a different, there's a change in leadership in the NRA in the mid-70s, and then and it really took off in the early 80s, where they became heavily politicized, and that this was really about, you know, so even the motto of the Second Amendment that they have on their corporate headquarters, they took off the first piece of the right to a well-regulated militia for the security of a free state. That part of the Second Amendment is removed. And it is the individual's right to bear arms shall not be infringed is what is highlighted as the Second Amendment for the NRA. But again, I look at this, I think about how the NRA went silent when Philando Castile was gunned down, but how they were absolutely vocal when Ruby Ridge and Waco jumped off, and you had basically white folks killing federal officers and federal officers shooting back. and the NRA called those federal officers jackbooted government thugs.
Yes, in that case, it was really striking how the government became the bad guys, despite the fact that there were government reports saying, yeah, they were actually doing what they were supposed to do.
Right, right. I mean, so this is the piece where you see the radicalization of the NRA, and you see it becomes very apparent how gun ownership is linked with white citizenship.
And a political ideology.
And a political ideology.
And what that means then, given all of that, is that if someone talks about you not having a gun, not even all your guns, but one gun, or having some limits on guns, right, that becomes victimization. It becomes an attack. It again, this gets back to what I said before. It becomes something you have to defend against because this is, you know, this is your right and they're taking something away that you're due. And of course, virtuous me needs to stand up and demand what I need to demand. It's a really effective rhetorical place to stand. It's a hard one to counter, which is why right now, you know, we sort of live in an age of victimization culture. But this is, again, that same kind of logic.
Well, there's that weird idea that if there's any kind of gun safety legislation, it means that everybody's going to lose all their guns. And that's, of course,
well,
not all what it means.
Right. There's like a knee-jerk jumping, right? Yep. If anyone says, let's just make it so that, you know, you can't, this kind of gun, or let's just make it that you have to be this age, or, you know, that there's a leap from that to they're going to take all our guns.
Yes.
And there's no gray area in any of this.
And I don't know about you, Carol, but I grew up, I know Joanne didn't, I grew up around guns. I'm totally comfortable with guns, but not AR-15s. It's a whole different world than it was when we were growing up.
But this is the thing. It's like how you see, now you see politicians holding semi-automatic weapons as
That's
part
crazy.
of their political ads. Vote for me because I will hunt these rhinos, right? Vote for me so I can kill these Democratic Klansmen. Vote for me.
That was today.
Woo! You know, and so begin to think about, this is where political violence becomes normalized.
Ideology. This is violence and victimization as ideology.
Ideology, yes.
Weren't there pretty strict gun laws when the Second Amendment was written, Joanne?
I don't know how strict they were, but there were laws. I mean, it's the same with abortion as well, where the bad history being done in some of these Supreme Court decisions are looking back in time and saying it's always been this way. You know, this hasn't ever been regulated, or there has always been laws there in the case of abortion to make it illegal. People always hated it. And in essence, in these recent cases, none of that is true. You know, we all know as historians, you know, history is always a lot more complex and a lot more interesting than line drawing in that way. But it's really handy in Supreme Court decisions, apparently, to draw lines.
That's right, Carol, right? That there were actually gun ownership laws in colonial America, especially in the cities, right?
Absolutely. There were all, you know, laws about what kind of gun you could have, who could have them.
Plus, they weren't very effective.
No, they really weren't. You know, they didn't shoot multiple rounds in a minute, right? They were old. They were guns. They were like muskets. They were like these flint tocks where you had to, and then, you know, it was, right?
I have to say, I shot one. A black powder dueling pistol.
Okay.
And I, of course, you know, I wouldn't expect my aim to be wonderful, but there was a sharpshooter member of the police force there with us, and he was having the hardest time aiming this thing, right? He would shoot it, and we would all be like... So, yeah, these guns were not the same thing as our current guns.
Right.
And they did take... As somebody was skilled, it could take... You know, about a minute to a minute and 20 seconds to load. And I've shot them not infrequently, and they do. There's a lot of steps to doing it.
Right.
And so that brings up somebody else's question. Weren't the militias really ineffectual? The militias in the wars of the 1790s were basically guys with guns and beer who liked to shoot at people, but were really bad at getting shot at. Is that correct? Sounds right to me. But
well, I would tweak that a little, which is, you know, they were civilian militia organizations, local men who, you know, mostly were armed, and they drilled. So it wasn't as though they were like guys with a beer saying,
one guy who's really good. Well, there was, everybody else.
In the militia in New Haven, there's at some point I saw a list of the people in it, and there was someone who was just defined as an eccentric barber. but so, you know, it was just the local people, but they were at least drilling so that if something bad happened, they'd have a clue what to do. This doesn't necessarily mean that they did it. But yeah, these are local people, you know, getting together. And really, we better know how to do something in case we're attacked is what a militia is.
But one of the things you think about, like Shays' Rebellion, which blew up in Massachusetts, where you had folks attacking the government because they didn't like a tax policy. And so Massachusetts tries to call out the militia to deal with Shay's rebellion. And the militiamen are like, nah, I'm not feeling this. In fact, I'm feeling Shay, right? And so you get lots of militia folks running over to Shay, you know. And so the Boston merchants have to hire a mercenary army.
They create a private army.
Right? To take out Shay's rebellion. So this was part of the milieu. Oh God, I hate that word. but this was part of the ethos that was happening at the time when the Constitution is being drafted. They're dealing with the militia really not being able to be reliable. They're also dealing with Shay's rebellion and seeing that the militia just was like, yeah.
So that brings up the next question here. Is there a historical link between the militia and the police? How does one go to the other, or do they? Because a lot of people think the police come out of the slave patrols, and they don't. They're actually formed before that in the urban cities. Is that correct?
My colleague, Leslie Alexander, is actually working on that book right now.
You can use her as your lifeline. Give her a call.
Yo, Leslie!
This is not the show Who is the Weakest Link.
Right?
I don't want to be playing that show.
Right. But one of the things that to me is clear is that the role of the slave patrols in being able to have the authority to track Black folk in order to be able to question Black folk. You know, why are you here? And to have that kind of authority, you know, to be able to confiscate stuff from Black folk, all of that to me is reminiscent, emerges into the kind of policing ethos that we think of today. I mean, and it's part of what here in Georgia, where we had the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, who was the Black man running through a white neighborhood. Oh my God. And you have these white guys who believed that they had the right to track him down. That was a slave patrol mentality there. You know, he's not somewhere he's supposed to be. And we have the authority to basically.
Again, whereas certainly in urban areas, police very often were not policing elite white men, right? Who would do something like duel, right? Which is against the law. And they would be like, well, I kind of heard, but maybe, you know. So, you know, again, selective, really depending on who you are in a lot of ways and just sort of determining in one way or another when something actually has an impact and is in power and when it isn't in a really selective kind of a way mm-hmm. that can be easy to not see if you're looking back with a distance of history, but which is really there.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that what bothered me most about that case, aside from his murder, was the fact that, you know, there's always crap that goes on in a society, but one of the things that we have trusted at times in America anyway is that our legal system and the people involved in the legal system will bring those vigilantes, which is what they were, to justice. And honestly, you know, I dove pretty deeply into that case and I was horrified
yes.
at the phone calls between the prosecutor and the person involved in the shooting, and he had worked for her. And at the end of the day, no, you don't really have a case. There was a video which I watched, which is horrific. It is
yes.
horrific.
Yes.
And to say, well, this just proves you're innocent. Had that man not tried to clear his name, the guy who was sitting in the truck not tried to clear his name and mm-hmm. taken that to a radio station to put on their website, there would have been nobody who was brought to justice for
exactly, that. Exactly, exactly, exactly. I mean, and think about it. The police and the first two DAs saw that tape and thought, there's no crime here. It took activism. It took activists to just raise 10 tons worth of hell to in fact generate enough publicity and enough concern about what had happened down there in order to get this case into a DA's office that was really going to do the work.
Thank you for joining us backstage.
Be sure to write to us with your thoughts and questions at letters@cafe.com. See you next time.